Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast of excellence, talking about The Red and the Black, book one, chapter six. I am exhausted. I've just done like 2 hours on my elliptical machine. I don't know why I set this stupid goal for myself, but I'm glad I have. I'm getting there, but right now I feel awful. So let's get through this. I think it's a long chapter. I wonder if I'm... Let's just do the... We'll do the conversation quickly so I can read the whole chapter. How does that sound? Jan Brunt said, "Oh no, we're diving headlong into another doomed romance. Is there any other kind of 19th century literature?" Matic Strick 1 said, "Couldn't help thinking about the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock when reading this chapter. Julian reminds me of that type of character. Don't know the song. I'm sure it's about a young man falling in love with an older woman." Maybe. Maybe not. Our Treat said, "The masculine ways people thought necessary for a man to be handsome made her afraid. Sure, Julian, you're weedy and kind of shy, but Madame de Ranal is needy for a weedy, shy guy." Is that a Flight of the Conchords quote? Julian got it going on. Got it going on. Oh, it is. There's a link to it. I haven't watched this for a long time.
"Your beard is good."
"Your beard is good."
Compliment for you, your beard. Just a compliment about your beard being good.
Just a compliment about your beard being good. Oh, now I have to watch all of Flight of the Conchords again. Thanks a lot, Our Treat. Yeah, I'd say Madame de Renal is way into this Julian boy. And I think we all know where this is going. Altreet says, "I can relate. The masculine ways people think necessary for a man to be handsome, or these days hot, don't make me afraid, but I do find vanity muscles to be a turn-off, muscles that people need for their jobs in construction, farming, factory work, etc. Manual labour type jobs don't count. Those are fine and usually not as ostentatious anyway." Yeah, I agree. As a guy, I am kind of naturally, I don't know, heavy set. I got broad shoulders, big chest. I'm kind of like big. I'm not tall, but I'm like stocky, I suppose you'd say. But I don't like that. I want to be slender. And I go to the gym. When I went to the gym, I had my little consultation with the guy that makes your program. And he said, "What are your goals?" And I said, "Oh, I just want to look good in clothes. I want to lose a lot of weight and get kind of, you know, I'm three sizes bigger than I should. And I just want to look good in clothes." And he goes, "Don't you want to look good out of clothes, though?" Like, he was really clever for coming up with that. And I was like, no, I don't. I want to look good in clothes. I don't want to be all bulky and muscly. I want to be slender. And I want to be able to put on a nice skinny jacket and it just look normal. And they go on about that whole, you know, like bear wrestling muscles and all this. And it's like, I've never needed to wrestle a bear. I've never been in a fight. I've never needed to be strong, really. Other than, you know, when I need to, like, I don't know, do some kind of construction work or whatever. Manual labor type stuff. But I've never really needed to wrestle a bear. So, no, I don't want to be humongous. What am I saying? So anyway, Our Treat, I'm with you on that one. Which is why I just spent 2 hours on my elliptical machine, because I've got half a wardrobe full of clothes that don't bloody well fit me, and I would very much like to get back down to the size where they will. That was a bit of a sidetrack. Couple of thoughts, says non-creative handle. Excuse me. Yes, the budding romance. I was wondering what this dynamic was going to be like once Julian moved in. It'll be interesting to see how this plays out with Renal, as these types of affairs tend to go badly. Judging from earlier comments, it seems this has been a popular theme with the Hemingway List. Yes, it has. Although we haven't had this kind of cougar. Is that what they call it? Cougar. situation, I don't think. I'm very intrigued with Julian's character. Before I started the book, I watched a YouTube video that said Julian was one of the great characters from literature, but I haven't taken much of a liking to him yet. He's showing the signs of a budding politician, with how much he seems to suppress his opinions of his hero Napoleon at a whim, while doing other things like going to church, knowing that they're to make him look good. It's still early, so they can't say much, but I am eager to see how his character changes. Yeah, he's got a little bit of a arrogant side to him. I'm detecting a little bit of arrogance in young Julian, and I'm also detecting a little bit of what's the word I'm looking for? He's a bit arrogant, and he's a bit something, something, who cares? Anyway, this is chapter 7, Elective Affinities. They know not how to touch the heart without bruising it. That's from a modern writer. The children adored him. He did not care for them. His mind was elsewhere. Obnoxious, that's the word I was looking for. He's a little bit obnoxious. Whatever the young monkeys did could never annoy him. Cold, fair, impassive, and nonetheless loved, because in some way his arrival had driven boredom from the house. He was a good tutor. On his part, he felt nothing but hatred and disgust for the superior society into which he was admitted. At the lower end of the table, it is true, which perhaps throws light on the hatred and the disgust, there were certain grand dinners when it was only with great difficulty that it contained his hatred for everything around him. On one of these occasions, St. Louis' Day, at Monsieur de Renal's, when Monsieur Valenod was holding forth, Julian was on the point of betraying himself. He escaped into the garden under the pretext of looking for the children. "What paeans to honesty," he cried to himself. "One would think it's the only virtue, and yet what regard, what unworthy respect for a man who has obviously doubled and tripled his fortune since he took over the administration of poor relief. I bet he's even profited from the funds meant for foundlings, for those poor things whose misery is even more sacred than that of the others. Oh, monsters, monsters! And me as well. I'm a sort of foundling, hated by my father, my brothers, my whole family." A few days before that St. Louis Day, walking by himself and saying his breviary in a little wood called the Belvedere, which overlooked Loyalty Promenade, Julian had vainly tried to avoid his two brothers, whom he saw from a distance coming towards him on a lonely path. The jealousy of these coarse labourers was so provoked by their brother's fine black costume, by his air of extreme propriety, by the genuine scorn that he had for them, that they had beaten him up to the point of leaving him senseless and covered with blood. Madame de Renal, out walking with Madame Monsieur Valenod and the sub-prefect, arrived in the little wood by chance. She saw Julian lying on the ground and thought him dead. Her shock was such that it made Monsieur Valenod jealous. He took alarm too soon. Julian found Madame de Renal very beautiful, but he hated her because of her beauty. It was the first block on the road to fortune on which he had almost stumbled. He spoke to her as little as possible, trying to forget the transport that the first day had impelled him to kiss her hand. Eliza, Madame de Renal's lady maid, hadn't failed to fall in love with the young tutor. She spoke of him often to her mistress. Mademoiselle Eliza's love earned Julian the hatred of one of the valets. One day he heard this young man saying to Eliza, "You don't want to speak to me any more since that filthy tutor came to the house." Julian didn't deserve this slur, but with the instinct of a good-looking young man, he redoubled the pains he took over his appearance. Monsieur Valenod's hatred redoubled too. He stated publicly that such vanity was not seemly in young cleric. Save only for the soutane, Julian wore clerical costume. Madame de Renal noticed that he spoke to Eliza more often than usual. She gathered that these talks were caused by the paucity of Julian's tiny wardrobe. He had so little linen that he was often obliged to send it out to be laundered, and it was in these little concerns that Eliza was useful to him. This extreme poverty, which she had not suspected, touched Madame de Renal. She would have liked to give him presents, but did not dare. That inhibition was the first painful feeling that Julian caused her. Up until then, the name Julian had been synonymous for her with a wholly intellectual feeling of pure happiness. In distress at the idea of Julian's poverty, Madame de Renal talked to her husband about making him a present of linen. "What simplicity," he replied. "How make a present to a man with whom we're perfectly happy, who serves us well? It is when he's negligent that you must stimulate his zeal." Madame de Renal felt humiliated by this way of seeing things. She wouldn't have paid attention to it before the advent of Julian. She never saw the extreme neatness of the young Abe's turnout, otherwise so very simple, without saying to herself, "How does the poor boy manage it?" Little by little she felt fit pity for all that Julian lacked, instead of being shocked by it. Madame de Renal was one of those provincial ladies one might very well take for a fool for the first fortnight's acquaintance. She had no experience of life and no desire for conversation. Endowed with a delicate and discriminating soul, the instinct for happiness natural to all beings meant that most of the time she paid no attention at all to the doings of the gross people in whose company chance had thrown her. If she had received the slightest education, she would have been remarkable for her naturalness and liveliness of mind, but because of her status as an heiress, she had been brought up by nuns who were passionate devotees of the Sacred Heart of Jesus, their passion kept alive by a violent hatred for the French enemies of the Jesuits. Madame de Renal had enough native good sense to forget very quickly all that she had been taught at the convent because of its absurdity, but she put nothing in its place and ended by knowing nothing. The premature flatteries of which she had been the object because of her status as heiress of a great fortune and a definite inclination towards fervent piety had given her a mode of life turned wholly in upon itself. With an appearance of the most perfect compliance with others and the abnegation of self, which the husbands of Verrieres pointed to as an example of their wives, and was the pride of Monsieur de Renal, the settled habit of her soul was really the result of mostly lofty disposition. The princess celebrated for her pride pays for more attention to the concerns of the gentlemen surrounding her than did this so apparently mild and modest woman to anything her husband said or did. Up until Julian's arrival, she had not really had attention for anyone but her children. Their little illnesses, their griefs, their small joys occupied all the capacity for feeling in this soul who in all her life had adored no one but God. She, when she had been at the Sacred Heart in Besançon. Without her deigning to say this to anyone, an attack of fever suffered by one of her sons put her almost in the same state as if the child had died. When in the early years of their marriage the need to confide had driven her to the intimations of this kind of distress to her husband, they had regularly been greeted by a burst of clumsy laughter, a shrugging of the shoulders, accompanied by some trivial maxim on the foolishness of women. This type of jocularity, above all when it bore on the illness of her children, twisted the dagger in Madame de Renal's heart. This is what she encountered as successor to the forced and honeyed flatteries of the Jesuit convent where she had spent her childhood. Her education was accomplished by sadness. Too proud to speak of this kind of sorrow, even to her friend Madame Derville, she imagined that all men were like her husband, Monsieur Valenod and the sub-prefect Churcot de Maugiron. Coarseness and the most brutal insensitivity to anything which did not concern money, status and decorations, blind hatred for all the arguments which went contrary to them. These seemed to her the natural attributes of the sex, like wearing boots and felt hats. After long years, Madame de Renal was still not accustomed to these money men in whose midst she must live. Hence the success of the little peasant Julian. She found a soft delight, all glowing with the charm of novelty, in the sympathy of this noble and proud soul. Madame de Renal had swiftly forgiven him his extreme ignorance, which became an added grace, and the crudity of his manners, which she was able to correct. She found that it was worth listening to him, even when speaking of the most ordinary matters, even when it was a case of a poor dog being crushed as he crossed the road by a peasant's hurrying cart. At the sight of this sad event, her husband gave his loud laugh, while she saw Julian's beautiful black eyebrows, so finely arched, contract. Generosity, nobility of soul, humanity gradually seemed to her to exist only in this young Abe. She felt for him alone all the sympathy and even admiration these virtues arose in finely disposed natures. In Paris, Julian's relations with Madame de Renal would swiftly have been simplified, but in Paris, love is born of fiction. The young tutor and his sly mistress would have found the explanation of their situation in three or four novels, or even in some couplets from the Gymnase. The novels would have outlined for them the parts to play, showed them the model to imitate, and sooner or later, although with no pleasure, perhaps reluctantly, vanity would have forced Julian to follow the model. In some little town in the Aveyron or the Pyrenees, the slightest happening would have been decisive because of the fiery climate. Under our more sombre skies, a poor young man who is ambitious only because his sensitivity of spirit gives him the need for some of the enjoyments available to wealth, can meet every day with a woman of 30, genuinely modest, taken up with her children, and far from finding exemplars for her conduct in novels. Everything proceeds slowly. In the provinces, everything happens little by little. Things are more natural. Often, in considering the young tutor's poverty, Madame de Renal was moved close to tears. One day, Julian came upon her actually crying. "Oh, madam, has there been some misfortune?" "No, my friend," she replied. "Call the children and let us go for a walk." She took his arm and leant on it in a way that seemed odd to Julian. It was the first time she had called him her friend. Towards the end of their walk, Julian noticed that she was blushing profusely. She slackened her pace. "Someone may have told you," she said without looking at him, "that I am the sole heir of a very rich aunt who lives in Besançon. She heaps presents on me. My sons make progress so wonderfully that I beg you to accept a little gift as a token of my appreciation. It is only a matter of a few louis for your linen, but," she added, blushing even deeper and stopping speaking. "What, madame?" said Julian. "It would be unnecessary," she went on, lowering her head, "to speak of this to my husband." "I am unimportant, madame, but I am not low," replied Julian, halting, his eyes sparkling with anger and drawing himself up to his full height. "That is what you haven't sufficiently thought about. I'd be even meaner than a valet if I put myself in the position of concealing from Monsieur de Renal anything relating to my money." Madame de Renal was astounded. "Monsieur le Maire," continued Julian, "has given me 36 francs on 5 occasions since I've come to live in this house. I'm ready to show my expenses book to Monsieur de Renal, or to whoever it may be, even to Monsieur Valenod, who detests me." At the end of this outburst, Madame de Renal was pale and trembling, and the walk came to an end with neither one nor the other able to find a pretext for renewing the conversation. A love for Madame de Renal became more and more impossible in Julian's proud heart. As for her, she respected him, she admired him, she had been rebuked. Under the pretext of making up for the humiliation she had unwittingly caused, she allowed herself to pay him even more tender attentions. The novelty of these proceedings constituted Madame de Renal's happiness for a week. Their effect was to soften Julian's anger in part. He was far from seeing in them anything resembling personal affection. "That's it," he said to himself. "Just like the rich, they humiliate you and then think they can put everything right with a few monkey tricks." Despite her resolutions in this respect, Madame de Renal's heart was too full of the matter, and still too innocent, for her not to tell her husband of the offer she had made to Julian and the way in which she had been repulsed. "How," replied Madame de Renal, "Monsieur de Renal, much nettled, have you been able to put up with a refusal from a servant?" And when Madame de Renal protested at this word, "I speak, madam, as did the late Prince de Conde, when presenting his chamberlains to his new wife. All these people here," he said to her, "are our servants. I've read you that passage from Besenval's memoirs. Essential reading on matters of precedence. Everybody who isn't a gentleman, who lives in your house, and who receives a salary, is your servant. I'm going to have a word with Monsieur Julian and give him 100 francs. "Oh, my dear," said Madame de Renal, trembling, at least don't do it in front of the servants." "Yes, they could be jealous, and with good reason," said her husband, leaving and thinking about the amount of money. Madame de Renal sank onto a chair, almost fainting with unhappiness. He's going to humiliate Julian, and it's my fault. She felt disgusted with her husband and hid her face in her hands. She resolved firmly never to make any more confidences. When next she saw Julian, she was trembling all over. Her chest was so constricted that she could not manage to speak a word. In her embarrassment, she took his hands and pressed them. "Well, my dear," she said to him finally, "are you satisfied with my husband?" "How could I not be?" replied Julian with a bitter smile. "He's given me 100 francs. Madame de Renal looked at him uncertainly. "Give me your arm," she said at last, with a note of courage new to Julian. She was brave enough to go as far as the bookseller in Verrières, in spite of his terrible reputation for liberalism. There she chose 10 livres worth of books to give to her children, but these books were ones she knew Julian wanted. She insisted that there, in the bookseller's shop, each of the children write his name in the books that fell to his share. While Madame de Renal was pleased with having made amends to Julian in this audacious way, he himself was amazed at the quantity of books he saw in the shop. Never had he dared enter so profane a place. His heart throbbed. Far from being concerned to find out what was going on in Madame de Renal's heart, he thought deeply about the means by which a young student of theology could come to own some of these books. Eventually, he had the idea that it might be possible with some skill to persuade Monsieur de Renal that he ought to give to his sons, as an essay topic, the story of famous gentlemen born in the province. After a month of manoeuvring, Julian saw his idea succeed, and to such a degree that some time afterwards, in talking to Monsieur de Renal, he ventured mentioning a course of action that would be far more painful for the noble mayor. It concerned taking a subscription out at the bookseller and thus contributing to the fortune of the liberal. Monsieur de Renal fully agreed that it would be prudent to give his oldest son a visual impression of numerous works he would hear mentioned in conversation when he went to the military school, but Julian saw Monsieur de Renal's balk at going any further. He suspected a hidden agenda, but was unable to make it out. "I believe, Monsieur," he said to him one day, "that it is highly unsuitable that the name of a prominent gentleman such as de Renal should appear in a bookseller's squalid subscription list." Monsieur de Renal's brow lightened. "It would also be a very bad mark," Julian went on in a humbler tone, "for a poor student of theology, if someone discovered one day that his name had been on the list of a bookseller hiring out volumes. The liberals would be able to accuse me of asking for the most infamous works. Who knows, they might even go so far as to write the titles of such perverse books in after my name." But Julian was losing the scent. He saw the mayor's face resume an expression of embarrassment and dissatisfaction. Julian kept silent. "I've got my man," he said to himself. A few days afterwards, in Monsieur de Renal's presence, the eldest child asked Julian about a book announced in La Quotidienne. "To make sure there's no opportunity for the Jacobin party to triumph," said the young tutor, "and to furnish me, nonetheless, with the means of satisfying Monsieur Adolphe, a subscription should be taken out at the bookseller's by the least important of your people." "Now that's not a bad idea," said Monsieur de Renal, obviously delighted. "At the same time, it is necessary to stipulate," said Julian, with that grave and almost unhappy air that comes so readily to certain natures when they see the success of plans they have long desired to succeed. "It is necessary to stipulate that the servant in question should not be able to take out any novel. Once in the house, such dangerous books could corrupt the women, and even the servant himself." "You forget political pamphlets," added Monsieur de Renal in a lofty tone. He wanted to conceal his admiration for the crafty mezzotermine devised by his children's tutor. Julian's existence thus came to consist of a series of petty negotiations, and with their outcome, interested him much more than the marked preference for himself that was waiting to be read in Madame de Renal's heart. The moral situation in which he had lived all his life reproduced itself at Monsieur de la Mare's house at Verrières. Here, as at his father's mill, he profoundly distrusted the people with whom he lived, and was hated by them. Every day he observed in the talk of the sub-prefect of Monsieur Valenod, of other friends and of the family, how little their ideas corresponded to the reality concerning things that happened under their eyes. An action that seemed to him admirable was precisely the one which would incur the blame of those around him. His inner response was always, what monsters, what idiots. The laughable thing is that, with all his pride, he frequently understood absolutely nothing of the subjects about which they spoke. In his whole life, he had talked sincerely only with the old surgeon major. The little information he possessed was about Bonaparte's Italian campaigns or surgery. His youthful hardihood relished accounts of the details of the most frightful operations. He told himself, I would not have flinched. The first time that Madame de Renal tried to have a conversation with him other than about the children's education, he started to talk of surgical procedures. She went pale and begged him to stop. Julien knew nothing else, so in his daily life with Madame de Renal, a most peculiar silence came to prevail when they were alone. In the drawing room, however humble his mien might be, she saw in his eyes an air of an intellectual superiority to all who appeared at her house. But finding herself alone with him only for a moment, she perceived him visibly embarrassed. She was uneasy, for her feminine instinct told her that in this embarrassment there was nothing tender. On the basis of a peculiar impression taken from some story of the good society as seen by the surgeon major, Julien felt humiliated from the moment silence fell in female company, as if the silence had been his particular fault. This feeling was 100 times more painful when they were alone. His imagination, full of overblown, almost Spanish notions of what a man ought to say when alone with a woman, offered him, in his distress, only invisible ideas. His head was in the clouds, yet he was incapable of breaking out of that most humiliating silence. Hence his severe manner during his long walks with Madame de Renal and her children was reinforced by the cruelest suffering. He mistrusted himself horribly. If by mischance he forced himself to speak, he ended up saying the silliest things. To complete his misery, he was conscious of his own absurdity and exaggerated it, but what he did not see was the expression of his eyes. They were so fine and spoke of so ardent a spirit that, like good actors, they sometimes imparted a charming meaning to that which had none. Madame de Renal noticed that, when alone with her, he never said anything interesting except when, distracted by some unforeseen event, he forgot to think of paying compliments. Since the friends of the household did not indulge her by presenting her with new and brilliant ideas, she delighted in Julien's snatches of wit. Since the fall of Napoleon, all appearance of gallantry had been severed, barred from provincial manners. There is a fear of being deprived of one's post. The scoundrels seek the support of the congregation, and hypocrisy has made most wonderful progress even in the liberal ranks. Boredom redoubles itself. There remain no other pleasures but reading and agriculture. Madame de Renal's wealthy heiress of a doting aunt, married at 16 to a fine gentleman, had never in her life either felt or seen anything, at least in the world, like love. Only her confessor, the good curé Chelan, had really talked to her of it, concerning the pursuit of Monsieur Valenod, and he had created such a disgusting image that the word represented for her nothing but the most abject debauchery. Love, as she had found it in the very small number of novels that had by chance come to her attention, she regarded as an exception, or perhaps quite out of this world. Thanks to this ignorance, Madame de Renal, perfectly content and constantly preoccupied with Julien, was far from feeling the slightest self-reproach. All right, there we go. Chapter down. He's got some chapter creep going on here. They're getting longer and longer. I think every single chapter has been longer than the previous so far. That's all good. We don't mind. We'll just start breaking him in half. All right. Thanks for listening. I will see you tomorrow.